says, Andy wants a floor, but not a ceiling. What do you think about that?
Look, I think that it's hard for me to divorce like what I think is politically achievable with what I think should happen. And, you know, there's a Speaker of the House from California and other powerful members of Congress from California. And there are other, you know, HIPAA is an example of another privacy law where states can exceed the floor. The Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act is another example where the states can exceed the floor. I think what's a little bit different about this is that it is, you know, you have these comprehensive federal laws, and particularly to the extent some of them have broad private rights of action, that, you know, that really affects the way companies do business. And so I'm not prejudging how it will or how dramatic that effect will be. I think Andy's right that it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, I think I'm sure right after GDPR went into effect in Europe, there were articles about investment by advertising technology companies in Europe. And I don't know who wrote them and where the statistics are from, but they suggested that there was substantially less investment in Europe because of some of the changes there. And if that's how things play out in California, or you know, and I think the likelihood that they'll play out that way depends a great deal on how the Attorney General interprets the statute and the enforcement priorities he brings. And so that will drive, I think, how some of this plays out. I wanted to also, because I didn't mention up front, briefly mention on data breach specifically, that there is another trend in states. So Ohio last year enacted a law, and Iowa now has a proposal that say, fine, we recognize that people have claims under state tort laws if there are unreasonable security practices, but they create safe harbors or shields and say, if you have a program that has reasonable security, and they generally tie those to different industry frameworks like the NIST cybersecurity framework, then you are insulated and there's a shield, or at least some shield from the from being sued under state breach laws or state rather state torts alleging unreasonable security. And that's similar to something that exists. New York has a what's called the SHIELD Act that goes into effect this year as well. That doesn't have a private right of action. It's a law with regulatory enforcement, and it says you have to have reasonable security. You have per se reasonable security if you meet one of these standards, or if you have an information security program that has these elements. And so I do think I would be remiss if not mentioning that, you know, to the extent that the standard is, you know, there's some liability, whether it's regulatory or the risk of litigation for not having reasonable security, that it's also worth thinking through what is reasonable security and how can companies, you know, achieve reasonable security, and are these expectations fair? And so there's at least, you know, I'm also, you know, I think there's at least some school of thought that having bills like these that say, hey, if you have this and this is a high standard, then you have per se reasonable security, and that's an incentive for companies to move towards those standards.
It's interesting. So a lot of good thoughts in there. I know coming from the Commerce Department and working with NIST closely, they spent many years working on their cybersecurity standard. Now I think it's in its second or third iteration. It really is kind of the international standard for cybersecurity. They really, really resist having that become kind of a de facto regulation or rule by which a company does not follow exactly what the prescriptions are, then you would be in violation of one of these, you know, potentially the tort. You couldn't use it as a defense in the tort. So I know there's a little bit of controversy in terms of how you keep that effective. Libby did mention the international component here too. We're gonna go, if you can start, audience, we're gonna go to Q&A in just a few minutes. So I got a couple quick topics, and then start thinking about your incisive questions right now, or whatever questions you wanna ask. So internationally, it's kind of a similar situation as what we have with the federalism solution. So would either of you want to kind of comment on GDPR, the Europeans, and how anyone else in the world is impacting what we do here? Because again, many of the companies that are probably defendants, or in most of the cases anyways, are international technology companies, so they're operating in the world and not just here in the United States. So that's, I kind of threw that international question out to the...
Yeah, I've got to confess, I really can't speak much to that because our, as a litigator, we're litigating U.S. courts for U.S. citizens, and it's very difficult to haul a European or an international company that's not based in the U.S. into court, even if they did the worst thing in the world. So for that reason, we don't bring suit against a lot of companies that don't have any tether to the U.S., nor do we, for the most part, bring claims under the GDPR. Right. I know what it is. I don't know it as well as Libby, obviously, but...
So Libby, do you have any thoughts on GDPR in particular?
I'm not going to say a lot on it, because it's also, you know, I have privacy colleagues in London and Brussels who I work with closely, but just for background, GDPR has, like the EU directive before it, requires reasonable data security to protect personal information. New to the GDPR is an obligation to notify the data protection authority, the relevant data protection authority, within 72 hours of a personal data breach that meets certain triggers, so it's likely to cause some harm. And so that, you know, companies are doing that today. My sense is that EU regulators have been inundated with notices from different companies, and I think the conventional wisdom is that that's because in 72 hours you haven't been able to do the kind of investigation you would need to get comfortable not notifying, and so companies tend to over-notify. But that is, you know, it will be interesting to hear from EU regulators in a year or two once they have a little more experience. The other jurisdiction that I'm hearing a lot about is China. So China enacted a cybersecurity standard 2 years ago. It first applied only to certain critical infrastructure. Then it applied to any quote-unquote network operator, which was essentially any website. Then they actually said, no, it doesn't. It only applies to critical infrastructure. And then they went back, and I think now it applies to any network operator. Substantively, I can't speak to exactly what's required, although one of the requirements is to do a third-party audit or assessment, and a company could do that against a standard like NIST or a standard like the ISO 27001 or 27002.
Great, good. Well, as a representative of George Mason Law School and the Law and Economics Center, I also feel obligated, Stuart, to inject a thought here as well, which is, you know, we all want to protect consumers to the greatest extent possible. We don't want anyone's personal information to be breached. And yet, solutions, if they overreach, can have negative impacts on consumers as well. So the free stuff they get online, the cost of other services that are provided could go up if you cast the net too broadly. Professor James Cooper at the law school had a panel in early December, I think, where two scholars rolled out some research they had just done on the impact of GDPR in the EU in terms of investment and who's willing to participate in their market based on the GDPR standards. And what they found was that a lot of economic players were withdrawing from that market, and particularly newspapers, publications, other things like that, or kind of low margin businesses that had great consumer benefit but really couldn't afford to comply with GDPR requirements. And the Europeans don't like to hear that. They get upset when you kind of provide data like that, but I think it's, you know, you can look at the data and see what you think of it for yourself. But just keeping in mind that solutions, whether they be in the state, federal, or international, can also have adverse consequences to consumers by attempting to protect them too much. So just a little side, the other side of the coin here that we need to make sure that the solutions that we're measuring what happens with the solutions to consumers on both sides of the coin. So with that, I think I'm going to open it up to the audience and see if there's any questions for our experts. Yes, sir. If you want to identify yourself and then ask your question.
My name is Justin. I'm from California.
And I'll try to repeat the question as well, because we don't have mics, right? So, okay.
My name is Justin from Congressman McNary's office.
Okay, Justin from Congressman McNary's office.
My question is for Ms. Cantor. Are you expecting any revisions or lobbying to CCPA before the July 1st deadline?
Just repeat, of course.
Sure. The question is about whether there might be any revisions or lobbying around the CCPA before July 1st. So there's sort of two different tracks. There's legislative and regulatory. Around legislative, I don't think there's going to be a lot. I'm aware of one amendment pending that would relate to adding an additional exception for certain data processed, there's already an exemption for clinical trial data, but certain health data processed for research purposes and narrow circumstances. The one piece that I think might, there's an exemption that expires in 2021 for employee data and data of business customers, partial exemptions. And so I expect there to be legislative activity around potentially extending those exemptions in 2021. I do think there's a lot more happening on the regulatory side. The draft regulations were published in October. Comments were due December 6. I think the AG has previewed, reading the tea leaves, that there will be another short comment period. So we'll see further revised draft rules. And there will be like a 15-day period probably to comment before those rules are finalized. And the rules have really important components of them. They add new requirements. They amplify some of the risks I talked about around the data security risks about responding to consumers with access requests that aren't properly verified. So I think there'll be a lot of activity there. And then there's a lot of lobbying and government affairs activity happening in the other states like Washington and Illinois and places.
Thanks. Any other question? Yes, in the back there.
Hi, my name is David. I'm with the office of Congressman Rufusberger. My question is, I guess for whoever wants to answer, you mentioned that a concern with an overreaching solution would be protecting consumers too much. What, can you specify what that would look like or what that would be?
Well, so again, the GDPR largely kind of exists in not just data breach, so it's a lot of privacy protections. But so one thing that might hurt consumers would be withdrawal of, you know, over 100 U.S. publications that are no longer going to be provided in Europe. So if you want to, if you've been subscribing to, you know, I don't know, I don't have the list off the top of my head, but the surveys, the scholarly work kind of went through examples of that, and I can get you that information. I think, Stuart, it was, I'm pretty sure we have at least an audio of that, the Cooper panel in December that was on the Hill, I think, as well.
Yeah, it's on our website. They have the audio.
Okay, so yeah, I hate to send you a wild goose chase, but you probably find that on the website for the law school.
I think maybe a complimentary point is, and I am, it's a weird position to be in, right? Because across from Andy, I feel like I have to take the perspective of like big tech or big company, and that's not, I think really my perspective is that for the most part, the companies I work with spend an enormous amount of resources trying to have the best data security possible to protect data. And there are mistakes, there are human errors, you know, there are technicians that haven't gotten properly trained, and I am aware of big data breaches that have happened, maybe Andy's been involved in, where the mistakes rise to the level of seeming unreasonable. But for the most part, companies invest a lot in this because they want to protect personal data because they care about consumers, but they have trade secrets they want to protect. They have the CEO's email that they want to protect and don't want to be hacked, right? That was compromised in Sony, and that was a nightmare for the company. They have, there have been major ransomware attacks that shut down the business, where the NotPetya attack from a few years ago literally caused certain companies to have no operational workstations or computers or servers for a period of time, and that's really bad for business, right? So it's not just something they're scared about from the perspective of protecting consumers. They have, their interests are aligned in preventing this. And so I think one way to phrase the question is, when you think about what the right regulatory framework is, and you're trying to incrementally increase investment in data security, or what are the incentives you're trying to create, and thinking about it, like what incremental benefit do you get from adding certain requirements, I think. And that's not to say that there aren't requirements that might be good to add. Maybe some companies would benefit from something more prescriptive, but I think that's an important lens to see things through as well.
I can kind of add to what Libby said as well. Kind of coming from a Verizon experience, you know, we deal with a lot of Fortune 100 companies, and they're extremely competitive. And if you get the reputation that you're not safeguarding your customers' data, that's kind of a kiss of death from a business perspective. So a lot of the big companies spend a lot of money working on this, and that's not to say stuff doesn't happen, because it does, and it will continue to happen. But they care very much about it from a reputational standpoint. What I would also say is that our economy doesn't, when you're doing business with a Fortune 100 company, you're not just doing business with that company. They have thousands of subcontractors and apps and other things that are kind of incorporated into that. One of the things when I was at Verizon, and they continue to do this now, is they put out this data breach investigations report, DBIR, every year. And I happened to look at the 2019 report, and it's actually pretty interesting to look at if you want to go back and kind of review it. I think they've been doing it for about 10, 12 years now, and they have maybe, I don't know how many partners, it used to be 25, 30 partners, from the Dutch cyber police to other police and secret service here and other corporations, and they kind of aggregate all the data breach information. The summary of findings is fairly easy to read, and one of the things that jumped off the page at me when I was looking at this is that they kind of look at the who is being targeted, who are the victims, and 43% of breaches involved small business victims. And again, those small businesses could be a part of an arrangement with a large business as well, but when you're talking about small businesses, you want to make sure that they are protecting their customers as well. But you don't want to have the procedures they have to follow to be so onerous that it drives some of those out of business as well. So again, I'm not saying which way to go, but just keeping both of those sides in mind is important. If you all move forward and start looking at federal legislation, kind of think about dialing it in at the right level and really look at a lot of the kind of economics of what happens when you're drafting that information.
Yeah, I agree. Look, you got to look at the economics. I see it from a different side, though, as you can imagine. And I'm glad to hear, Libby, that your clients really care about it. I've been involved in, 7 or 8 data breach cases, some very large ones, and it's not been my experience that they really care about cybersecurity. It's the opposite. They either have a very small budget for cybersecurity, or worse, they might have the protocols in place. They might have all the prescriptive rules that they need to, but they haven't staffed it. To me, that's just as bad. So we care about it, but we don't care about it enough to really manage the personnel that can really do the job. So, there's two sides.
Right, you gotta dial it right, so the incentives are at the optimal level.
I agree. And I think the CCPA, actually, you talked about small businesses, I think it has a revenue limitation in terms of the company. So it's not gonna impose, any guidelines or liability on small companies, or the real small businesses.
And if, a small company, there's nothing to stop that company from putting something on their website or advertising and saying, yes, we still comply with the CCPA as well, so it's kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval. Any other questions? Yes, in the back here.
I understand that there are a lot of data breaches that include businesses and organizations that give out information, but do you guys have any advice just for the common citizen or consumer to protect their security, basically?
Yeah, I'm probably not. That's a great question, and I don't know that I'm the best one to answer that, because I think I've had my data breached I've been in the federal government for quite a while, so the OPM breach, I've had, probably the any number of those, so I'm not going to comment, but I've not done a good job of protecting myself, but Andrew or Libby?
From a personal perspective, hey, I tell my kids and my adult children, don't go on every site you think you want. Don't use every app that you think you want, because the more it's out there, the more you're at risk. The other bit of advice is what we try to do in these cases, and we actually get bad press for it, it's really the best thing to do. if you're part of a breach, get credit monitoring, get real credit monitoring, because breaches will happen. It's inevitable. The question is, how can you react to that? And the best way to react is to keep monitoring. If you can do credit freezes, if you're not going to apply for an auto loan or a mortgage, try to keep a credit freeze on. It's a pain in the butt, but it will protect you, because that's mostly what's going to happen. So a credit monitoring service that is worth its salt is really, really valuable to you.
And I think just kind of good, you know, online hygienics as well. I mean, I clicked on something. It really looked like it was a Microsoft link a couple of years ago. It was when I was at the Commerce Department, and right when I did it, I called up our tech guy. I said, "Oh, I think I messed up." And it turns out it was a phishing exercise. The DBIR report has a listing of kind of what are the tactics that are utilized, and 52% are hacking, 33% have kind of social engineering, which is phishing and kind of calling someone and getting them to give you your information. So at Verizon, for example, we really, really trained everyone. So when our operators are on the line and someone calls up and says, "I'm so-and-so, and here's, some information that's, the address or maybe date of birth and whatever," and then they say, my husband's incapacitated and I need to get his information, whatever. I mean, they're really good. We had the head of the Secret Service cyber division come in and talk to us at one point when I was at Verizon, and he really scared us all with the access that the bad guys have. He said there was one guy who was kind of notorious named Albert Gonzalez. At some point in his career, claimed to have access to 3/4 of the credit cards in the world. So if you're another bad guy in the dark web and you want to get 100,000 credit cards to go out and get, you call Albert and he'll give you what you need. The good news is that some of the things that the DBIR reports are, the threats are going down. So a lot of the skimmers, like on the ATM machines, and some of those things that are easier to push back against, companies have been instituting more protections in those areas. So some things are going up, some things are going down, but the data breach report has some interesting stuff.
Just to tick a couple things, don't use the same password on different sites, at least if you have sensitive information. Don't connect to public Wi-Fi without going through VPN. And don't bring your devices, except loaner devices, into high-risk jurisdictions like China.
Yeah, that was when we have very strict rules in the federal government about where you can bring your devices. So every time I traveled outside, even to places like the UK and other places, they make you swap out. Now, that's not the easiest thing to do for individuals, but just be aware of when you're there to not be logging into certain things and keep it off when you can keep it off and things like that. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Yes, sir.
Just a comment on the last question. Look at the password managers too. I think that's an easy way to use different passwords for different websites. In terms of actual litigation, if a federal standard would be put into place, would the volume of litigation occurring rise drastically? Just in your opinions?
I think it depends. It depends what the legislation says. Again, if there is if there's statutory damages, I don't think it will increase the number of cases that are filed, but if you had that, you would certainly, if you have that component in a federal statute, you would certainly see that claim in there. The case is going to be brought regardless. Again, because you've got good common law protection in a lot of states, either negligence or contract or the UDAP laws. So this is just maybe another piece of the arsenal, but I don't think it would increase the actual number of cases filed.
And just putting the law school hat on again as well, Congress needs to make sure that it writes its laws clearly and doesn't have ambiguity. And someone who worked in this body for many years, I understand that most bills that come out are a product of compromise, and oftentimes members of Congress can't actually come to a meeting of the minds on specificity, so they kind of keep it at a higher level and then say, well, the regulators will fix it out. So So our Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State looks at a lot of these issues. So keep an eye out for Gray Center activities if you're interested in administrative law issues. But kind of the deference in terms of our AUER deference and Chevron deference issues, look through a lot of those, kind of making sure that Congress is right and clear. But for you staffers in the room, you know, sharpen your pencils and make sure that you're writing clearly so that we don't have, I know Andy likes litigation and we like litigation for Andy, but it is expensive for the litigants to do that. So the clearer Congress writes, the less cost is imposed on all the parties and more clarity that we have in the law, which helps to not have chilling behavior that Congress didn't intend to have in the first place. One last question, Stuart? Okay. Okay, we'll do two, but we'll do them quickly. So you first and then next.
Sure. So if possible, could someone just speak quickly to the Federal Trade Commission's evolving regulation of data security issues and how that fits into the rest of this conversation?
Sure. Really quickly. So it's complicated. So Federal Trade Commission has the authority to enforce Section 5, which prohibits unfair and deceptive trade practices. And the FTC has used both its deception and unfairness authority to bring enforcement actions against companies. So a number of companies, Twitter and others, have been dinged for having unreasonable security practices. The FTC doesn't have general rulemaking authority. In the 70s, Congress took that away through the Magnuson-Moss Act. So it's only where Congress specifically says, FTC, you have the authority to make rules, like around the Children's Online Privacy Act or the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, that the FTC could do that. And a number of the bills federally would do that. They would say, FTC, make prescriptive rules without going through this Magnuson-Moss process that's not reasonable around data security. So
And privacy generally.
And privacy generally, some of them, yes. So that is sort of briefly, does that answer your question?
And also, okay. The FTC would have jurisdiction. So if a company put a policy on their website and didn't follow that policy in terms of data breach, then that would be a deceptive practice. And that is, so if there are industry codes that are put out, those are often sometimes very effective as well because you have federal enforcement of those codes in effect. When you hold yourself out as living up to those codes and you don't, then the FTC can come after you.
Yeah, and I would just clarify, to add to what I said, not to clarify what you said, clarify what I said. The FTC, even in the absence of prescriptive rules, like exist for financial institutions under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, the FTC has been bringing data security cases. So there are dozens. And it has published sort of best practices. Here are the things we've brought cases for that we think are kind of unreasonable and therefore things that we have the authority to use Section 5 for. That's been tested. So there have been cases in the 11th Circuit and 3rd Circuit about whether the FTC has that authority. And thus far, the FTC seems to feel comfortable it has the authority. So there's sort of one approach is the prescriptive rules. One approach is sort of you have to have something reasonable and the FTC post, after the fact can come back and second guess what you were reasonable.
And it becomes kind of a de facto common law of reasonableness and data breach. That is a different approach as to more prescriptive legislation.
Yeah, let me just add one thing to that. The FTC, like most government agencies, does go after companies if it thinks they've done something unfair or deceptively. It rarely, like most government agencies, does not seek to recover funds or get any relief for the people who have had their data breached. That's not unique to the FTC. I'm not saying anything bad about the FTC. That's just the way it is.
Right.
So that's why I think keeping a private right of action in whatever kind of law that is.
There have been meaningful penalties, though. So Equifax, $700 million. Oh, this is the settlement. Sorry. I can pull it up for you, but there have been, yes. So like in Equifax, for example, there was a $300 million dedicated to a consumer restitution fund. Facebook subject to a $5 billion consent order, and Uber, $148 million. So.
And last question.
Data, and I have heard more and more that there are more
other data aggregators that have bought your data and that you never even knew to tell them no? Like, how are we doing this sort of, like, what's it called? Like, where it's applicable to what's already out there?
It's such a good question, I think, from a practical perspective. So practically, I read there's so many ambiguities under the CCPA. This is all with the asterisks that there are counter arguments, but the CCPA applies to businesses. You could be a data broker and still be a business, in which case, if you're reselling data, you would have the obligation to provide consumers the right to opt out. But you've raised a very good question, which is, how do I know if I deal with company A and they share my information with the data broker to go to that data broker website and exercise that opt out? And there's not a good way. So the CCPA at one point would have required identifying the third part, company A, to identify the third parties with which it shared information. The final version of that doesn't do that. It says you have to identify the categories of third parties. And most companies aren't going to do that exhaustively, so you don't know that your information's been shared with Epsilon or Axiom, or, you know, you could Google all the big data brokers and just make requests, but you otherwise don't have that visibility, which is why I think a lot of the federal proposals, not this year, but that have existed in prior years, have really focused on the data broker industry.
Oh, retroactive. That was the word I was thinking of, like the fact that it's already gone and sold. And
The AG rules, one of the new things they introduce is the concept that if you make an opt-out of sale request for a business, they have to then tell all the companies that they've sold your information to within the past 90 days, not to sell your information.
So
but
a little bit,
yeah,
it's a great, it's really a great question. We face something similar in the Equifax case. But nobody signs up with Equifax. Nobody actually walks into a department store that has Equifax on the title. You're not buying a service from Equifax. The people you're dealing with, or the companies you're dealing with, are using Equifax. So it was sort of a double whammy. So wait a second. I didn't even give anybody permission. I guess implicitly I did, but I didn't have a direct relationship with Equifax, and yet they have my data and they lost my data. So it's that's something that really ought to be considered going forward. It's a great question.
Great. Well, listen, thank you all very much for being attentive, a great audience, and please join me in giving a hand to our guests.